Not the doctor, and not her given name, Minda Shields. She was a ghost. She never married, never had children. No one ever bothered to pursue her. Maybe because of the way she looked, face scrunched, prematurely gray, appearing old long before she ever was. Maybe it was because the right man never seemed so important, and the right woman always felt impossible to acquire. Or maybe it was the way she behaved. All business, people said, which was another way of saying unkind. She didn't mean to be. It was just her way. If someone came in whimpering about stomach cramps or heat stroke or whatever ailed them, she would say, "We're here for symptoms, not sympathy." She understood the way the body fit together and came apart, the way it ruined and healed, and she wanted to help a person in the same way a builder might mortar a crumbling foundation, or a gardener might pull a weed in an overgrown pot. As the years passed, she tried to be better. She tried to help more, mother more. She wanted people to turn a needy face toward her in a bad time. She had no one but her patients. That is how she knows Clark, as a patient treated for alcohol poisoning. She pumped her stomach and brought the cups of sugar water to her lips and held her hair as she vomited into a bucket and monitored her for 24 hours. She checked up on her weeks later, finding her at the stables, asking if she needed anything.
"What makes you think I need anything?"
"I'm just checking. That's all. Just seeing if you're all right. Healthy."
"I'm fine." Clark looked at her curiously. "Hey, you want to get a drink?"
A patient treated for alcohol poisoning asking her out for a drink. The doctor almost laughed, but she could tell Clark asked the question without irony. To her, drinking was like breathing, like talking. And the doctor decided she would like to share that with her. She wasn't one to visit bars, but she visited one that night. Clark had a way of rallying people, convincing them of what they never realized they wanted. It wasn't one drink or two, it wasn't 2 weeks or three, it was a long seduction, a slow, secret sharing, before Clark revealed their plans and asked if the doctor might join them. They needed someone like her, to care for them, to be needed. How good that felt. The doctor realized then she couldn't remember the last dream she dreamed. She couldn't remember the last patient she saw, or the last meal she ate, or the last book she read. Those things happened, but they happened in the haze that had become her life. Nothing was worth committing to memory any longer. So she said, yes, she would go. She would go anywhere Clark asked. Clark might be reckless, given to wild mood swings, occasionally crippled by her indulgences, but there was something about her. The way she punched the air to punctuate a sentence. The way she never stopped moving except right before she was about to give an order. The way she threw back her head when she laughed, as if her laughter were a swallowed sword. Her heart was too big. It owned her. And when she was angry or happy or sad, you knew about it. Because her heart couldn't be hidden, slamming everyone within 50 yards with its drumbeat. It was hard to doubt someone like that, someone who lived so fully. The doctor is taken. They all are. They are all there because of Clark. She is their rallying force. Which is why, when the doctor leaned over her cold, pale body, when she dug through her bag and searched for anything that might restore the life to this beautiful, precious person, she felt wounded in a way she never had before. She understood at last what it meant to be the weeping patient. It was not her care that brought Clark back. It was not anything the doctor pretended to understand, a force beyond any education. But none of that mattered. All that did was Clark's survival. About this, the doctor feels, with no other comparisons available in her life, joy. The doctor dotes on her, tidying her blanket, cleaning the dressing on her wounds, telling her to rest, rest, please, pushing back her hair and kissing her on the forehead. Whatever she needs, the doctor will take care of. She tells Reed to leave Clark be. She doesn't need you. And she doesn't. The doctor has never liked him. He's the kind of man women love, with with his predatory smile, his stalking walk, his way of standing too close, but he always struck her as a rank dog eager to hump a leg. She does not care for Louis, either, for other reasons entirely. She has a grandnephew, a boy of 7, who can play the fiddle brilliantly, but avoids eye contact and makes strange conversation with himself. There is something similarly unsettling about Louis, who has always seemed to occupy a different room, even when in the company of others, and who has abilities beyond any of their understanding. A magician, a miracle worker, an aberration. She's not sure what word best suits him. The doctor thought he would die. After the transfusion, if that's the right word for it, he remained still for 2 days, his breathing so shallow his chest barely moved, his pulse so weak she gave up trying to read it, sensing only one impossible heartbeat a minute. The doctor stayed away, but Joea sat by him. She could talk now. The doctor suspects she has been able to talk for some time, but rarely speaks, as if rationing her words. If the doctor asks how he is doing, she says, "The same." And if she asks if Joea has brought a damp rag to his lips, she says, "Yes." Gradually, his color flushed, and his eyes began to shudder beneath their lids, and he began to speak in his sleep, uttering words that were clearly enunciated, but in no recognizable language. Joea is gone, foraging in the woods, when the doctor approaches him tonight with a rag and a bowl of water. She strips him, bathes his thin, wasted body by roughing the rag across his skin. The campfire crackles nearby. The stars are like a fistful of salt flung across a black blanket. His ribs are too visible, pressing painfully against his skin. His black hair, once so short, is now a messy corona. He smells strangely metallic.
"What's going on inside of you?"
she asks, not expecting an answer. But when she dips the rag in the bowl and wrings it out and brings it to his face, his eyes spring open. Before she can cry out, he has seized her by the wrist and shot straight up. "Where is my tin?" he says. She tries to pull away from him.
"Clark threw it in the river."
He blinks a few times, swallows hard.
"She what?" "She was right to do it."
She explains that there is no better time than now to wean himself when his body is restive, healing.
"She gave up the hooch. Now it's your turn to be strong enough to do the same. That bitch."
At this point, the others have gathered around them.
"You bitch!"
he screams at Clark. He blinks hard, as if he remains unsure of his whereabouts. The doctor knows his mind and body must feel gripped by an arthritic fist. He releases her then. His face tightens, and he brings a hand to his chest.
"What's wrong?"
the doctor says, and he says his heart. It feels like one big wound, like nails have been pumped through his veins and clustered there. He lets his head fall back and struggles to breathe and struggles to keep his eyes open. He obviously wants to say something more, to curse them, wish them dead, but can't find the breath. Sleep pulls him away like a current. His mouth is moving, but they don't hear what he says, the words seeming filtered through water so that he might as well be sinking past the reaches of moonlight to the stony bottom of the nearby river. Chapter 24. Sometimes, when no one else is looking, Reed takes out the box, the one Danica gave him. The wood is black and slick, as long as his hand and as wide as his wrist, and heavy, the weight of a book with many words inside it. He runs a finger along its edges, smears a thumb across its lid. He imagines tossing it in the fire. He imagines digging a deep hole and burying it, and rolling a boulder over the top of the disturbed earth so that no one would ever find it. But he also dreams darkly about turning the knob, flipping the latch, leaning forward to see what springs out. It would be so much easier to give up, to stop plodding forward, to put an end to the heat and the hunger and the thirst and the fear and the suffering The others see so much promise in the river, but he knows that the lushness does not extend beyond the green vein of it, the desert still reaching on all sides of them, like a sea of yellow ash, and the sun so blinding it seems to take up the entire sky. There must have been a time when he believed. Why else would he have come if he had not dreamed of a better life? But that time has passed. The other day, when kicking their way through a house and salvaging what they could from it, he came upon a body in a brass bed, the mattress rotted down to springs, the corpse shrunken down to mummified skin with the hair still clinging to it. He stared for a long time and thought about how nice it must be to be dead, how comfortable to lie down and let darkness take you. You would never have to worry about anything again. The others must feel the same way, even if they don't say it, the weight of this dead world pressing down on them. Even if they're not, like him, fondling their revolver and considering how a bullet might taste when swallowed, there are so many other ways to surrender. Lewis sleeps most of the day, but when he is awake for an hour, sometimes two, he writes in his journal or takes short wobbling walks along the river, using a long white branch as a staff to keep his balance. On occasion, he sits around the campfire with a blanket thrown over his shoulders, though no one but Joea and Clark seem comfortable speaking to him. Reed has always been wary of him, but now feels repulsed. Can Lewis even be categorized as human, or is he more a mutation, like some giant white bat or hairless sand wolf, a product of this world and not the last? Other. Soon, when Lewis is strong enough, they will pack their things and press forward, because Clark demands it. She demands they think of their country and not merely themselves. She demands they consider the implications of what they're doing, their small rebellion against the sanctuary, a gateway to something much larger, national redefinition. Ever since they dragged her from the basement, ever since Lewis brought his wrist to hers, she woke with a renewed life and vigor, and when she speaks of their mission, when she speaks of this new America, she manages to somehow make it feel real, not some ridiculous abstraction. They listen to her. They believe in her. She brought them all this far, not Reed. He is a totem leader, and not even that, not any longer. She gives them the hope that allows them to be led. Hope is a good and dangerous thing, Reed thinks. Hope is the moment that never comes, and life is the shit you wallow through when chasing it. They have not slept together in weeks. More and more often, he has trouble keeping his patience around her. He tries to sit by himself. He tries to lie by himself, but she always finds him. When she asks a question, sometimes he does not respond at all. And when he does, his answers are often clipped, sullen. She wants to know why he is so angry, and he tells her he is tired, that's all. He's so tired, which is and is not the truth. He has fantasized about her death. A snake will bite her. Her horse will throw her. She will eat a poisonous mushroom. When the bat stole her, he couldn't help but feel a kind of relief. Now we can rest. Now we can stop this race to nowhere. That's what he thought. Every morning when Lewis wakes, his hand goes immediately to his pocket, searching for the tin that isn't there. Reed has seen him suffer through his days and nights. He knows about the sweats and cramps and headaches and bad-tempered hallucinations. He understands because he feels much the same without her, Danica. He misses her like a drug. His nose in her hair, his tongue along her collarbone, her nipples tightening into points when traced by his fingertip. He hates himself for his weakness, but cannot deny it. His need for her. She once, when they were still naked and breathing hard and pressed together damply, said the word love into his neck. When he asked her to repeat herself, she said, "It was nothing." And he said, "No, you said something." But she would only dart her tongue from her mouth and trace the shape of his ear. Whether she actually feels love for him, he doesn't know. But he must for her. What else would have drawn him back to her again and again, despite the danger?
What else could make him feel so bruised inside now that she is out of reach? He hears her breathing in the river. He tastes her in the salt of a pebble he clacks between his teeth. And for so long, he has imagined her face over Clark's. Sometimes the only thing that keeps him going is the thought of them together in a lush green space with rain falling softly. Earlier today, they speared 7 trout from the river, and now they crisp and brown over the fire. They offer Lewis some, but he waves it away. His skin appears as pale and brittle as an eggshell. Clark asks how he's feeling, and he says his joints burn as if padded by coals, and every blink feels like a snuffed candle. She asks when he might be ready to pack up and move on, and he says, another day or two. Then he coughs into his fist, says that before they go any further, this one time and one time only, he plans to send his owl to the skies and deliver a message to the sanctuary. Clark asks him why in God's name he would do that. He hoods the blanket over his head and tightens his grip on it, making a kind of bonnet. His face is lost to shadow except for the sharp white nose peeking out. To give people hope, of course. He has an acidic way of speaking that shrinks his audience into something so small and insignificant he might flick them away. He explains that the mayor has no doubt claimed they are dead, and who knows what dismissive lies he invented to excuse them away. If they are indeed journeying this far for more than themselves, if they plan to return someday and bring down the wall, then they need to give people a reason to hold out. York tongues a fishbone from his mouth, pulls it from his lips, and flicks it into the fire.
Going back? Damn. With all the miles we've traveled, with all the miles still waiting ahead of us, that is the last thing I want to think about.
Lewis ignores him. He will send the letter to Ella, and she will find a way to spread the news to others. Clark says,
if anyone sees that owl, she'll be dead.
I'm sure that's a risk she'll be willing to take.
Reed says, if you're sending a letter, I want to as well.
He feels Clark's eyes on him.
I have some people I'd like to let know I'm all right.
You said it yourselves. A letter risks lives. The more letters, the more lives. One will speak for us all. Lewis rises and excuses himself. He's tired. He must rest. He toddles to his bed now, 20 yards away from their campsite, a willing exile. He uses his staff to keep his balance and to stir the fire he keeps for himself. He adds 2 logs to it. With a rusty stiffness, he lowers his body to the ground. He wobbles there a moment, fighting sleep. But instead of crushing his head into a pillow, he reaches a hand into his satchel and extracts a piece of paper, followed by his quill and inkpot. Reed follows and watches from a short distance as Lewis begins to write, no doubt composing the very letter he mentioned, wishing to send it off before they can question him further. His pen slashes the paper with a speed unavailable to his legs. This is how he will always be swiftest, on the empty page, not the open plain, in his mind and not his body. But before he finishes the letter, his chin drops to his chest. His posture curls, sleep overtakes him. A minute passes. Then he startles awake and folds the letter in half and then in half again and again until it is a tiny white square. The owl perches on a nearby stump. He crawls over and kneels beside it. The action seems to exhaust him. He slumps against the stump, resting his forehead against it, like a man praying at an altar. He wakes when he loses his balance, when his body begins to slide. He reaches for the owl and toys with a lever. Its breast swings open to reveal a small cavity into which he fits the letter. By this time, all his energy is spent. He curls his body at the base of the stump and succumbs to sleep. Reed sneaks a sheet of paper and uses the still wet quill to compose a message. He pauses twice when Lewis stirs or hitches his breathing. His words splotch and the paper tears in his hurry. Then he folds the letter into a small square and seals it with pitch from a split log and tucks it into the owl's breast for Lewis to send skyward when he wakes.
Chapter 25. The thin man told Joea he would personally escort her from Utah to Oregon, where Aaron Burr awaited her. It was a long road, and he would protect her, so long as she obeyed him. He kept her wrists bound and her mind drugged with an opiate so that she wouldn't escape or attack him. She was so numb she didn't feel his hands on her during the night, and during the day she saw the landscape they traversed in a hallucinogenic blur. They rode through forests that had burned down to blackened lances, and others electric with the yellow and red music of fall. They rode across glinting fields of obsidian that looked as though the night froze and fell and shattered. They rode through striped canyons with whitewater foaming through their bottoms. They climbed cinder cones and buttes and stared out at the way they had come and the way they might go. Sometimes animals followed her, a jeweled cloud of bees, a parade of humpbacked, foam-mouthed bears trundling in a long line, marmots poking their heads from their warrens to whistle their greeting, vultures and eagles and crows drafting air currents, spinning in the sky, surrounding her with rippling shadows. A cluster of antlered deer encasing her like a basket that bore her north and west. She was followed, too, by dreams she could not shake. In them, a man visited her, the man named Aaron Burr. She could never see his face, but she could see enough of him to know he was old and bent, his bald head ringed by long white hair that tumbled down his back. He spoke in a whispery, papery voice. He told her she was special. He was special, too. They could be special together. If only she would come to him. If only she would listen. "Come," he said. "Come to me." She wondered if he was a ghost, like the ones Oma used to tell stories about who would drown you in a lake or lead you deep into the woods until you were lost. Burr made her startle the shadows. He made her nerves feel like twigs snapping. At first, she clapped her hands to scare his voice away, dug in her ear, shook her head as if to scrape out a mosquito. Then she began to listen. He wanted to protect her. He wanted to reach her. He wanted to teach her how special she was. Then, in the Cascades, the thin man's horse lost its footing. They were crossing a slope of scree at the time. The horse tumbled down the hill and took him with it. The ensuing rock slide mangled him. So did the horse, its body rolling over him, bending his body the wrong way. Joea waited a long time, long enough for her head to clear. Then she climbed down the hillside and retrieved the keys to her handcuffs, and collected the provisions from his saddlebags, and whispered goodbye to the lame horse, before braining it with a rock. At this point, she felt she had no place in the world, so she kept moving, following the voice of Aaron Burr, her only beacon. She could always sense people long before she encountered them. Trails and roads cut the ground, stumps sprinkled with sawdust appeared. They made a mechanical storm of noise with their hammers and saws. They stunk the air with their paint and oil and cooking. Some lived in small clusters, giving her some sense of what life must have been like before her father was killed and her mother taken. Walled villages with pigs rooting in pens and smoke rising from chimneys. Sometimes at night, to antidote her loneliness, she would walk unseen among them. She opened and closed their drawers. She stood over their beds and smelled their stale breath and listened to them make love or murmur their way through dreams. She pretended herself, just for a moment, part of a family. More than anything else, that was what she wanted. Family. Burr seemed to offer her that. She feared him. She still fears him. But in him she found a mirror. Someone who resembled her. Though his hair was a silvery white, though his bones were warped and his skin spotted, they were the same. When they first met, he took her hand in his and said, "You are like me." With these words, he repaired her loneliness. He made her feel like she belonged somewhere. She remembers the first time they sat together, in leather chairs, in a library full of light, and when she squinted at him, unable to see him clearly for the blazing sun,
He asked if the light bothered her.
A little,
she said, and he held up his hand, and the shutters slammed shut, and in the darkness that followed he laughed until he coughed and then said,
No, you try.
People love to use different as an insult. A spicy dish was different. A challenging book or painting was different. Someone who dressed unusually was different. She was different. Burr told her this prejudice came from fear. The fear of change. She was evidence of change. People found comfort in the boring and the ordinary, and she was extraordinary. This was a new country, and they were a new people. The next people. He would teach her how to use her gift, just as he would teach Lewis. They would help each other, and they would help the world. They were healers, builders, innovators, and it was up to them to fit together the pieces of a broken country. She often fingered the scar on her shoulder, the place where they'd branded her. And when one day she said, I wish I could carve it off, Burr said, That wouldn't do. That wouldn't do at all. It's your constant reminder, he said, that you serve me. He was good to her so long as she was good to him, so long as she did what he said. Traveling all this distance, seeking out Lewis, risking her life and his, that was doing what he said. And so long as she was successful, he would reward her. She was in it for the reward, for what he promised her. That is why she tries to keep quiet, keep her distance, keep from growing too familiar with anyone. Farmers don't coddle or even name the cattle they plan to slaughter. They treat them as they do the corn in the fields, as the product of a job. These people, that's how she likes to think of them, not as York or Clark or Reed or the doctor, but as people, a generalized mass. These people mean nothing to her. They could drown in a river, or puke up a bad mushroom, or fall on a knife, and she wouldn't care. She wouldn't. She won't. You get close to someone. If they get hurt, you get hurt. They are expendable. Every one of them but Lewis. That is what Burr told her, and that is what she keeps telling herself. But she can feel doubt tugging at her. She can feel anxiety tunneling through her like little worms. There was a time when she thought by Burr's side was the only place she could feel some sense of belonging. Until now. It's the boy's fault. The boy, York, desires her. Ever since he caught her beneath the gallows, ever since she took his hand and raced across the stadium with the vultures crisscrossing the sky above them, he has been following her. She knows this and secretly revels in it. The other day, when they sat around the fire, he seasoned a trout fillet with some dill she harvested. He ate it and spoke to her with his mouth open, talking nonsense, telling jokes, wondering what life awaited him in Oregon. He had always dreamed of opening a theater. What did she think of that? Did she think that was a good idea? And hey, what was up with the mark on her shoulder? The one she was rubbing now. The one she was always rubbing. It's nothing, she said, and dropped her hand.
It's a tattoo, right? You've seen mine. The jester's mask on my back. What does yours mean?
Rather than answer, she leaned in and stole a fillet from his plate and took a bite of it.
I'm hungry,
she said, around a mouthful. He smiled and watched her eat. She doesn't want to feel this way, her mind fizzy with attraction. She tries to remind herself to feel jealous, in some fashion betrayed. That's how she felt traveling all this way to retrieve the man who would share Burr's attention. She has tried not to get close. She has tried. She kept her mouth shut as long as she could, kept her distance even when riding alongside someone, but her loneliness, an emptiness that aches like a pulled tooth, is a lifelong disability. And when the bat nearly took York, she felt like it was taking him from her. They hoist their saddlebags, they sling rifles over their shoulders, pans clank from their packs, and ammunition chimes in their pockets. Joea eyes up the campsite one last time, a place that felt briefly like home to all of them, before hiking away, following the river, feeling a barb of guilt as she once more leads them closer and closer to a destination they may regret. Lewis, she knows,
will be protected by Burr.
But what will become of the others? Many things have changed since Lewis brought Clark back from the brink, including the connection between the two of them. Their eyes often meet, and when they do, he feels a rippling in the air between them like some electrical charge.
When she departs the camp to hunt, he worries for her in a way he never did before, his chest constricting. It is almost as if, with so much of him inside her, she has become an extension of him, a third arm, a second head, her heart beating in time with his, so that they seem allied on a cellular level.
"What's happening to you?"
she asks him one night, and he says, "I'm trying to understand the same." By the end of each day, Lewis's body feels languid but buzzy. He thinks often of his tin, aches for it, but no longer needs a dose of powder to quicken a connection, speed his tongue and hand. His mind, once walled in, is now free to chase paths never considered. He packed the journal, mottled calfskin cover, yellowed onionskin pages, to document. He has spent so much of his life clapped away in the museum, reading other people's words, studying and pinning and labeling the world as if it were a still life. By agreeing to leave, he agreed to activity. He left behind stillness for movement, engagement. If this is a new world, then who better to serve as its chronicler than he, the custodian of the old? In the beginning, every entry seemed some variation of this. Woke before dawn, rode hard through the day, made it to X location, small argument broke out over lost provisions, no water, everything dead. At first he felt a failure, and the world a failure too, everything a skeleton of what once was. Then things changed. Now that there is water, now that he has risen from near death, now that he has sweated and shivered off his need for the tin, his mind hastens faster and faster every day, a progression like an avalanche of sand. He feels he is expanding along with the world, both of them surprisingly, gloriously alive. Their purpose in exploring the country grows more and more wrapped up in his self-discovery, as if he were America, the next America, their geographies twinned. He scribbles down thoughts like these, along with a short record of their days and entries about whatever plants, animals, and insects he can observe.
"What are you writing?"
York says.
"Nothing."
He leans closer.
"The corpse of discovery, what's that?"
"The core of discovery, you idiot? That's us."
Lewis hunches protectively over the book until York shrugs and leaves him. He writes, too, about what is happening to him, about how Jawea is helping him. For most of his life, he has been able to contain or ignore it, what his father called vile and freakish, what the rest of them call magic. He refuses the word. Magic to him is illusion and fancifulness. Magic is the unexplained. He knows himself as a man of precise habits and logical thinking, and he knows the world as a realm to be sampled and studied and categorized. What is happening to him must be explainable. He asks Jawea to help him. Please. She wouldn't before. At first, she allowed him only brief and cryptic responses, sketched in the sand. Now, she talks. At first with reluctance, and then more and more willingly, the words tumbling from her as if learning to talk is learning to trust. In part, this is thanks to York, who walks on his hands and springs a flower from her ear and makes her smile, even laugh. And in part, this is thanks to Lewis, who opened up his wrist and risked death, and in doing so gained Joea's trust and proved himself worthy of the journey. Every day, she strikes him as more human. Whereas before she came across as a wooden carving that only resembled a young woman. He wonders if she sees a similar change in him. This is what she tells him. If they had left behind a world where a plastic tablet could store 1,000 novels, where high-speed elevators could shoot someone 70 stories high in a matter of seconds, where warheads could lay waste to whole cities, then that means there is room in the world for other kinds of technology. More elemental. One morning by the fire, Jawea tells him to watch. She reaches out and draws back her hand and opens her fingers
to show a ball of light spinning in her palm. She asks him to do the same. When he leans in, when he snatches at the flames, when he feels the heat still in his hand, he can't help but gasp and swat his palm, the fire falling to the ground. The grass catches, and he stamps out the blaze and looks around to make sure no one has seen. She tells him to try it once more. He sits there long enough to take 10 deep breaths before grabbing again at the fire. Another ball sizzles to life in his hand, and this time he holds it for many minutes until it blinks out with a twist of smoke.
Good,
she tells him. His dreams are as vivid as life. In one, Aaron Burr holds out his hand. Its palm cups a stone. He drops it. It thunks to the ground. Then he looks at Lewis and winks, and the stone returns to his hand, as if drawn there by an invisible string. He drops the stone, and it falls. It falls because of gravity, a force most people associate with the Earth. But it is more than that, a force that every object has for every other object. A tree has gravity. A chair has gravity. He has gravity. He asks Juwea what it means, and she tells him what Burr told her. If two people stand on opposite ends of a field, they both emit a small charge of gravity that will draw them toward one another, something that is supposedly too small to be felt. But we have all known people who turn every head, who catch every eye. People are pulled to them. They emit some force. Yet they are not bigger than anyone else, at least on the outside. If a rock falls, it falls down, not up, because a force, the force of gravity, draws it down. It is this same force that keeps an arrow from sizzling through the air for 1,000 miles, keeps a horse's hooves on the ground instead of pounding the animal upward in the air. To make a rock fall up instead of down requires another force, a force stronger than gravity. He thinks of the rockets they use to blast into space. An engine could do it. An engine made by man, metal and plastic, conceived by the mind, constructed by hand. Juwea tells him, there are forces. There is energy all around, not only in gravity, but in air and earth and water and fire. Energy that makes things slow and speed up, cool and burn, grow and shrink. And she is helping him discover this, like a child who finds his shadow and begins to cast his hands into doves, dragons. Today a shadow ripples across his journal. He looks up to see a flash in the sky, the sun reflecting off metal, the owl. It spirals toward them. The sound of its fast descent is as bright as a boiling kettle. Lewis holds out an arm and it lands there, and he sets it on the log beside the fire. The gears wind to a stop inside it. When he reaches for its breast, he pulls his hand back with a hiss, the metal hot from its flight. He tries again, hurriedly flipping open the compartment door. Sand spills from it. He fishes out the note folded inside. He ignores the others when they request he tell them what it says until he has read it through twice. His tongue wets his lips. It says, Dear Lewis, you can imagine my surprise and disappointment when I found you gone. Did I curse your name and wish upon you unimaginable pain? Yes, but I also hoped that you might live to write this note, just as I continue to hope you might live to write another, the next time, to tell the rest of us to follow. As you might imagine, things have been unwell since your departure, worse even than before. Hurry, be safe, and please do not forget about us. I will do as you asked, and share the news of your success. But your note ended abruptly, and it remains unclear to us what you want us to find in the dome. Ella.
Us?
Lewis says.
Who's us?
Reed snatches the owl. Its wings flap, and its claws rake the air. There is a noise inside it like an alarm clock dropped down the stairs. He peers into its hollow breast.
Is that all?
What else would there be? Why would there be anything for you? Lewis holds out a hand until Reed returns the owl to him. Then he starts for the forest. He does not look over his shoulder when he directs someone to bring a blanket. He knows they will. They follow him between the trees, into the shade, several degrees short of evening, but gray enough. Lewis indicates a low-hanging branch, and Clark throws the blanket over it. They huddle close. Lewis holds up the owl. There is a metallic snap, a motorized buzz. Its eyes glow. On the blanket, a burst of static solidifies into the image of a hillside strewn with red rock. A dead bush trembles in the wind. For a long minute, this is all they see, and Reed says, "What's the point of this?" And Lewis holds up a finger to hush him. At that moment, there comes a noise from the other side of the hill, a clopping and clanking, like some piece of machinery grinding into motion. No one moves or says a word, not even to say, "What is that?" Though they all wonder. A shape trundles into view, slowly cresting the hill. A man. Coulter. He rides an armored black horse and wears a wide-rimmed black hat that casts a shadow over his face. But Lewis knows him. He knows him immediately. One hand rests on the saddle horn and the other on the machete strapped to his thigh, the blade catching the sun like a crackling spurt of yellow-orange flame. Two sand wolves appear on either side of him, panting and pricking their ears and testing the air with their noses. "The man who killed my father," Lewis says, "has come to kill me." Chapter 26. Lewis must want her dead. That's what Ella keeps saying to Simon. He must want to see her dragged out of the sanctuary and shackled to the altar and torn to shreds, or whipped, or maybe bludgeoned or speared through the middle, chopped up into tiny pieces and fed to rats. He couldn't possibly want her to live. Not with the charge he has given her in this letter. "Ella, I need you to do something for me. Spread the news of our expedition's success so far. I am writing this letter from northern Kansas, along the banks of the Missouri River, near South Dakota. It is not a river bed, but a river, a genuine river, surrounded by thick green foliage. We have not yet encountered any human outpost, but I trust now more than ever that we shall. Where there's life, there's hope. We follow Jawea to a better place and a new country. You must find a way to communicate this to the sanctuary. I understand that this will be difficult, and I won't presume to know the best way you might go about it, but I'm certain you will do your best. Additionally, you must expose what is hidden in the dome. You will..." There the letter ends. "You will..." Simon says. "You will what?" She stands by the open window and reads by the dying red sunset. She crumples the letter into a ball, then hurriedly flattens it again. She should feel thrilled. She knows. He is alive. There is water. There is life. There is, as he says, hope, after all. But how on earth will she share this news with others without arousing suspicion that she is the source? She has no idea. And his impersonal tone, his arrogant presumption, his reckless directive, it's enough to make her want to write "fuck you" on a piece of paper and shove it in the owl and hurl it out the window. He is asking her to risk her life. Is a thank you, or a please, or an "I hope you are well" so much to ask? "I hate him," she says. "I hate, 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 hate him." Simon wears a fresh plaster cast that cuts off at the elbow. He has drawn on it a picture of a broken bone. The skin beneath itches as if socked by fire ants, and he keeps an old wire coat hanger handy to creep inside the cast and scratch those hard-to-reach places. What about the other one? On the bed lies the other letter, the one sealed and addressed to Danica Lancer. They crouch on either side of it, their faces propped in their hands, their cheeks bunched and their mouths fishy from the pressure. "Are we supposed to open it, you think?" he says. "Is that your name? You think that's going to stop me? I'm a thief, remember?" Ella tightens her lips into a pink button. "Go on, then." He fingers open the seal, and he unfolds its many creases and reads in a rush the words scribbled there. "My darling Danica," his voice comes out as a flamboyant yell, as if he were a street performer. "With every mile I travel, my pulse seems to weaken, as if I am farther from its source. My heart..." She rips the letter from his hand. "Let me see that." "It's just a stupid love letter." She reads silently at first, then aloud. "I didn't realize how much you mattered until I left you. And now I feel sick. I'm fucking sick. I'm fucking sick. 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 I want to eat rocks and puke blood and stab myself with sticks. I want to open that box you gave me and lick its center and let death come, because that would be easier than this. We're all going to die anyway. The world is eating us one by one, so we might as well die now. Simon says,
Wow, I thought it started off bad.
She goes quiet another few seconds before saying, I can't read anything in the last few lines. His handwriting is a mess, except the words death and love. A sound comes from the hallway. What could be a cough or a broom sweep or a boot scuffed across stone? Before Ella can process what has happened, before she can say, hide, or someone's coming, Simon has already snatched the letter from her hand, the owl from the bedside table, and darted out the open window, cat quick. She turns to face the sound, just as Slade darkens the doorway. He leans against the doorframe. The last bit of sun flares from the window, reddening his face, which the very next instant goes to shadow. He is smiling. His teeth are too small for his mouth.
Who are you talking to?
You can't just come in here.
Can't I?
His eyebrows are only a suggestion, two fleshy creases above his eyes, but they raise now.
Who were you talking to?
No one. She tries to say this casually, but she is not a practiced liar.
Really? I thought I heard voices.
Sometimes I like to recite Shakespeare to pass the time. His voice takes on an affected timbre when he says,
And oftentimes, to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles, to betray us in deepest consequence.
He takes one sliding step into the room.
That was Shakespeare.
There's daggers in men's smiles. That's Shakespeare, too.
Clever girl.
He has kept one of his hands behind his back all this time. He lets it show now, a jug of water dangling from a finger crooked like a tusk. He gives it a sloshing shake.
I brought you something.
Why?
I thought you might want it. I thought you might be thirsty. The rations can be difficult for all of us.
He takes another step toward her and extends the jug.
Here, take it.
She considers denying him, but knows that will only lead to more trouble. Slowly, she raises her arms to accept the jug. What he carries with one finger weighs down both her arms. The jug sweats. She sets it on the floor between her legs and feels the cold coming off it, licking her skin. Will you go now?
What's the hurry? And should I be offended that you haven't thanked me? That you're not asking me to sit down? That you're not bringing two glasses to fill so that I might have a taste?
He circles her twice, his footsteps heavy enough to send a trembling through her body, and then approaches the open window. He rests his hands on the sill, and the wood complains. He looks out on the turbines spinning all across the city, their blades cutting the air like weapons wound and spun. She does not know where Simon hides, maybe on the ledge just beyond the window, so she calls to Slade in a panic. You're right. Thank you. Thank you very much. You're very kind. He turns. His body eclipses the window entirely, casting a shadow across the room.
That's more like it.
The jug dampens the floor, wets her ankle, sends a chill up her leg. When Slade approaches her, she does not move, willing her body to remain still. Even when he leans in, as if to plant a kiss on her cheek, his mouth pauses next to her ear. She can smell him.
Wool. Onions.
For a moment there is only his breathing. Then it pauses. And he takes a small bite of her. She feels her cheek slurp into his mouth, feels the teeth chew down, feels the flesh clip away. Still, she does not move or cry out. She pinches shut her eyes and clenches her fists and waits and waits and waits until his footsteps retreat from her into the hallway, down the stairs. She does not dare to open her eyes, not until Simon climbs through the window and touches her cheek where the flesh is bitten and the blood dries in a tacky trail and says, I'll kill him before he touches you again. Chapter 27.
For a long time, they stand in a silent, wavering circle. No one needs to ask the question. They know their options. They can fight, or they can run. They look first to each other, well-rested but bony and slumped, their bodies like a bunch of broken dolls. And then their stares settle on Reed. He keeps his face downcast, studying the ground, kicking a hole in it, as if the answer might be buried beneath him.
"What are you all looking at me for?"
he finally says. And then,
"This is on you, Clark."
She does not hesitate.
"We run."
They have guns, and they outnumber Coulter, but they have been trained to fear him. With night as his ally, and with wolves as his weapons, some of them will probably die. Lewis guesses him a few days away. They plan to continue forward and keep track of his progress with the owl and hope to lose him or find a more defensible position. As they press on, the water steadily deepens. The river widens. They can wade past their knees. Houses dot the woods, choked with vines and set back on hillsides, sometimes with the gray, crooked remains of stairways leading to the water where docks remain like bridges to nowhere. They pass many boats, overturned, spun around, mired in the mud, birds nest in them, fish rest in their shade. Periodically, Lewis sends the owl skyward. Less and less time passes before it returns to them. 10 hours, 9 hours, 8. A horse cannot gallop as fast as the owl can fly, so Lewis can only guess his distance by studying landmarks in the footage. 4 days away, then 2 days away. Reed wants to drop his gear and sit down and flop his hands apologetically and say,
"This is the end."
The end of their journey. And the end of their dream. The end of their lives. The end of the sanctuary. And the human world, in whatever clusters it still exists, might not be far behind. He is gnashing his teeth and blinking back tears, ready to say, "Enough!" when they find the canoes. This is outside Sioux City, at a marina, where skiffs and john boats and bass boats and jet skis lie half-buried, where dock posts rise from cracked clay and the slats they once carried accordion all around them. Their wood is gray, beetle-bitten, pocked by woodpeckers. The shed door hangs at an angle, one hinge stubbornly holding on. When they open it, pigeons the color of storm clouds burst from inside. They wander into the sun-slatted shadows and find 6 Alumacrafts, 17-foot canoes stacked on a metal frame. They are splattered with bird shit, full of feathers and nests, but when dragged to the water, they float, even when heaped full of supplies, even when bearing the weight of their exhausted bodies, the canoes float, and they begin to furiously paddle their way up the river. In this way, they travel north and west. Every now and then, the canoes will come to a scraping stop, and they will climb out and portage to deeper water. And every now and then, they will look over their shoulders, as if they expect to see Coulter splashing toward them. They battle the current, but the current isn't strong. The finish flakes off their paddles, and cracks run through them, but they do their job, cutting through the water, drawing them forward. Lewis's shoulders and elbows ache, but he would happily paddle 1,000 years before he took another step. He prefers the canoe even to horses. Their speed might be slower, but their passage is so smooth, unlike the rocking jolt of his saddle that every day threatened to knock his bones from their sockets. Sometimes he cannot help but marvel at the novelty of it all. He is traveling by canoe. There is enough water in the world, more than he ever dreamed he would see, to accommodate a canoe. Water dribbles from his paddle. Water runs between his fingers when he dips a hand into the river and cups it to his mouth. Water dimples and splashes when a frog leaps off a rock or when a trout jumps in a rainbowed flash to seize a dragonfly. If he narrows his eyes until the world fuzzes over, he can almost forget what they have left, where they are going. But then, in the river, he will see Aaron Burr swimming alongside the canoe, wearing a flowing white robe and a necklace of black stones. He calls Lewis's name, drawing out the S in the swishing pull of his paddle. Once a day he sends off the owl, and as its flights grow shorter and shorter, so does time seem to stretch longer. An hour could be a day a year. So different, he thinks, from his time at the sanctuary, when time slipped like sand between his fingers, one day blurring into the next. There, nothing was new, nothing at stake. Every day he saw the same people wandering the same streets under the same sun. But out here, in the Deadlands, everything is new, everything a threat, forcing him to notice every sun-sparkled wave on the river, every shadow sleeving the shore. And the more you notice, the fuller time becomes, and the fuller time becomes, the more it drags. Even the light seems to fall more slowly between the branches. When the owl returns to him only 30 minutes after it departs, he yells out to Clark, telling her Coulter is close. The time has come. They must find a place to make a stand. Clouds boil ahead, grumbling with distant thunder and darkening a third of the sky. Rain trails from them like skirts of gray muslin. Lightning jags. The air shudders when thunder calls. They paddle toward it in silence, and the gray-black clouds violently expand, as if rooted in a volcano, an eruption carrying ash and fire. This is not a sky for big hopeful dreams like theirs. This is a sky for nightmares. 100 yards ahead, between two rushing threads of water, rises an island. They will go there, Clark says, as long as they need to wait for Coulter, an hour or a day or more. The surrounding river will stand guard, serving as their moat. The rain begins before they arrive, as hot as the sun's tears. Instantly, they are soaked. For a moment, they can't help but laugh at the novelty of it. Rain. Not a passing shower, but a deluge. The air so packed with water they might well have upended, sunk into the river. They pause their paddling and hold up their hands and open their mouths until their laughing feels like drowning. They can barely keep their eyes open against the lashing rain, can barely see the island they paddle toward, and by the time they arrive, the canoes have filled with enough rain to slosh around their ankles. Chapter 28. The island is thickly wooded and a half mile long, shaped like an arrowhead, the current sharpening its tip, carrying silt downstream to deposit at its bottom. In some places it is edged by steep clay banks with roots spilling from them, in others by stony beaches littered with logs. The storm has paused, but not passed. They are temporarily caught in some rift. Rain no longer drums the overturned canoes. The wind, once so powerful that it snapped several trees in half, has hushed. But the sky looks like spilled ink, and thunder mutters all around them. Lightning blinks so often they feel caught in some seizure. They stagger their positions along the western bank of the island, hiding behind trees, their rifles bristling like branches. They don't know where Coulter will appear, or if he will appear at all. York says maybe he won't. Maybe he'll keep searching the shore for some sign of them, trudging past them in the dark. Why search this island, of all places? Lewis cuts him short with a no, and when they look to him for an answer, he says, a dog's nose, a wolf's nose, is 100,000 times more powerful than man's. I realize it's hard to imagine, because we can only perceive so much of the world, but try to envision a bright yellow fog streaming from this place. That's how obvious we are to them. The veil of night overtakes the sky. Fireflies emerge, thousands of them. The air is so dark, palpably so, that they can see the shape of the shore by the insects' winking constellation. Above Clark, the clouds are high, churning in a black circle, while up the river the clouds seem so low their bellies graze the treetops. Lightning flashes and seems to crack the sky, while to either side of them the shorelines wink and swirl with the yellow light of fireflies. 1 hour becomes 2, becomes 3. They do their best to keep their eyes sharp, but time dulls their focus. If anybody sees anything, they are supposed to whistle. 2 short high bursts, followed by a long low note. But with the night birds beginning to call, everything sounds like a beckoning. Clark is curled behind a stump with her rifle resting on top. Every few minutes, one of her legs goes numb and she shifts her body until the leg prickles back to life and by then the other is cramping. She studies the shore, the lightning bugs sparkling there, the tufts of grass and thin-angled maze of branches beneath the green awning of leaves. Clark can hear the rain coming again, the hiss of it not far off.
She looks to her right and thinks she can make out the silhouette of her brother leaning against a tree. And she looks to her left and sees a spark of red, the lit bowl.